You're listening to Living Planet. I'm Neil King. And before we ring in the new year, we wanted to respond to some listener questions and share a few things that didn't make it into the show. And joining me in the studio for that is Living Planet's Kathleen Schuster.
Hi, Neil.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
Got through the year all right?
Yeah, I feel like I'm crawling to the finish line this year.
Well, we're almost there, right. And you brought some questions along, right? You went through the Living Planet inbox and had a look.
Yeah, that's right. So we've had several people write in asking questions. And we actually had a couple write in from Munich. They're not from Germany, but they had a question to do with our What's Betters. They wanted us to do a little bit of research on their behalf related to their coffee drinking habits.
Oh.
Yeah, so maybe we'll listen to that clip first.
Hi, I'm Chris from Brazil.
I'm Camila from Poland.
And we are talking from Germany. We love coffee and we often get a cup to go. But those paper cups produce a lot of waste and we are thinking about getting reusable ones.
But those are often made of plastic, they need washing and they will be replaced around every year. So how often do you think we should use the reusable cups to compensate for the paper ones?
Thank you, love the show, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, first of all, I'm just a really big fan of a couple writing in together and then recording a clip for us. That was great. So thank you for that, Chris and Camilla. So the question is, like, is it worth getting a reusable cup versus just getting your coffee to go and throwing away the cup?
But you researched this, right? You talked to an expert about this. This wasn't just
I talked Google to two experts.
Two experts.
Yeah, yeah. Covered my bases. Yeah, exactly. So there are a lot of questions that have to be answered with, you know, whether or not a reusable cup pays off environmentally. So the first question is, you know, what materials are you using? Because there are all different kinds, like plastic, stainless steel. How often it needs to be washed and what kind of environmental impact that could have. And then also the question of, like, how long you'd actually be using it. And that was their question. Like, does it really make sense to go reusable, especially with with the question of, like, what material is the cup actually made from? I don't know, like, do you use a reusable cup or?
Well, I've got a mug, but then here at the coffee machine, it's like, I think they're plastic beakers. They used to have they used to have plastic beakers. Sorry, it's paper cups now. But I tend to get the paper cups.
You don't ever bring your coffee from home?
Well, I have my teacup and it's like, I don't know, the teacup is just for tea. I don't use it for coffee. Coffee wouldn't work in this cup. I don't know. It tastes different. I think it tastes different.
Yeah. But I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people do use them and they're right to point out, you know, a lot of these coffee cups that you would have in your car or whatever with a, you know, a screw on lid, they tend to be made of plastic. And so that was their question with all of these things. So the first person that I contacted was this expert from South Africa named Dr. Pippa Naughton. And she's the director of a sustainability consultancy called The Greenhouse. Now, part of the reason why I wanted to get in touch with her specifically was because she was one of the authors on a report by the UN Environmental Program, and they had looked at literally dozens of these peer-reviewed studies in English that were trying to answer this very question. You know, does it matter what material a reusable cup is made from? How does it stack up against a single-use paper cup, etc.? And this is what she had to say when I asked her.
Actually, not at all. Interestingly, I would say if you're looking at a reusable cup, you're really not particularly worried about the materials because that's a relatively small portion of their whole life cycle impact. If it's got a really nice design, it's a really nifty product and does actually get reused 30, 40, 50 times, then that was the right material for that reusable cup. So I think whether it's a polypropylene or a silicon or a bamboo reusable, it really makes very little difference. The important thing is the design of the cup such that it will actually be retained, reused.
I found that quite surprising. I didn't think, I thought there would have been a big difference between the materials.
I think I was relieved because how often does that happen when we're researching these stories that somebody's like, actually, it doesn't make that big of a difference?
Yeah.
That's almost never the case.
But I do wonder, you know, with the biodegradable materials, for instance, would they make any difference?
Well, one thing to talk about first is in these studies that she was looking at, the first thing that you look at are these break-even points. So, for example, I just thought these numbers were really interesting. Like, if you're talking about, you know, a ceramic cup that's being used in your local cafe or coffee shop, do you want to guess how many times you'd have to use one of those for it to break even environmentally versus a paper cup?
Oh, okay. A wild guess?
Wild guess.
50 times?
No, well, okay, so I'm looking at a study from just a number from one study, and they said 350 times.
Oh my God.
But if you consider how many times a cup is used in a cafe, then actually that's not that much, right? You know, how many customers, how much turnover they have in a day. And what it all came down to was, you know, how efficient their dishwasher was, actually. That was like 90% of the environmental impact of that ceramic cup had to do with how it was being washed. So then if you start looking at other materials like stainless steel, it's like 130 times. And then when you start talking about plastics, coming back to your question, it's around 20 to 30 times. So the expert I spoke to about plastics is a man named Dr. Christian Moretti, and he's based in Switzerland at one of their largest scientific research institutes called the Paul Scherrer Institute. And his expertise is exactly on this question, life cycle assessments and plastic. And so I was asking him, like, does it really matter, you know, if I go buy some sort of 100% recycled plastic reusable cup or something that is some sort of mix of bamboo and plastic or some other organic material? He said, well, there's this one really interesting example with a bio-based plastic called polylactic acid. So this is how he explains it.
Polylactic acid, so this is PLA, and PLA is bio-based and is biodegradable and technically can be recycled, but this doesn't happen because it cannot be recycled together with other plastic. Yeah, it can be composted, but it's not technically feasible in many countries. So typically it gets incinerated or landfilled, and yeah, that's not what was designed for.
Well, okay. So, I mean, there are options with biodegradable plastics, but I also feel like there's a lot of greenwashing going on there. We should be very careful which bioplastic we go for, because some of them have the same structure as real plastics, right? Even if they're called bioplastics.
Yeah, and the point he's getting at is it really depends on where you live. Does the recycling system in your community able to deal with that in terms of the technology that they're using? It might sound great to buy something made of 100% recycled plastic or some sort of biopolymer. But if you're buying it because you think, well, it will definitely be recycled at the end of its life, that's where it's not so clear, you know. So anyway, what I found really super interesting, though, was that in all of these studies, there was no single material that came out on top.
Okay.
So it was just, you know, if you have a reusable cup, the simple answer is go with that.
Yeah, and hold on to it.
And hold on to it. Use it as long as you can. Mm-hmm. And then also, you know, if you're going to wash it, try to put it in a full dishwasher. Don't, like, just individually wash it. That was the other main point that both of them were adamant about.
Right.
Yeah, getting across. So it's actually a simpler answer than we usually have.
That's
kind of strange.
That's great. And I'm sure Chris and Camilla will be very chuffed by that. I mean, maybe they could even share a cup. No, they're a couple. No? Bring that footprint down even more. Right. Kathleen, we had another listener write in, and this was about the leather episode that you did. Very interesting episode, that.
Every time we talk about the leather episode, it just, the sound of that word just always sounds.
What does it conjure up, Kathleen? Tell
nothing me. Nothing in particular. Yeah, so we had this episode about whether animal-based leather versus non-animal-based leather was better for the environment, which is better. Mm-hmm. And over the course of that episode, of course, we had to talk about the environmental impact of the meat industry, because that's where the cowhides come from. And in doing so, we were talking about the water footprint, which is a pretty big one for the meat industry. And so a listener had written in, a man named James Allen, who's from Great Cotmarsh Farm in the UK, and he had taken issue with the amount of water we said it took to produce a kilo of beef. So his initial comment was that we had an error, which was, you know, I had said 15,000 liters of water for, and then I said 1 pound of beef. And I apologize. I think that was the American side of my brain switching to pounds instead of kilos. So it's 15,000 liters of water to 1 kilo of beef. And then his other issue was that, you know, this is a commonly cited figure, but it's actually incorrect. It's really misleading. So, of course,
fact check.
Yeah. So I thought, okay, well, you know, we're pretty meticulous with our fact checking, but of course, let's go back and look and see what we missed.
So who did you talk to about that?
So the first person that I called was an emeritus professor from the UK named Dr. Tim Hess. And his expertise is in water and food systems. He worked for Cranfield University, and he had written about this topic, specifically about the different types of water that get calculated when you're talking about 15,000 liters of water. It's not just, you know, the water that's pumped out of the ground. It's a lot of numbers that are coming together. But just for the initial question, I just asked him, Is 15,000 liters correct, or is this some miscited number and we made a mistake? So this is what he said.
So the number is more or less correct. There are various studies that have come up with similar sort of numbers, but it's not particularly useful.
So did he elaborate on that? Why it's not particularly useful?
Right. So it comes down to this question of what type of water you're talking about. And this was the other point that the listener, James Allen, had brought up too, which is that there are different types of water that are being calculated.
So that rainfall that is being used to grow the grass or the cereals or whatever other feed is going into the animal system is the green water. And from a point of view of sustainable consumption, I argue that that is not important because we can't do anything else with that water. We could do other things with the land, but not with the water. What we really should be interested in from a point of view of sustainable consumption is the blue water. So that's water that we're taking out of water resources to then use in the animal system, because that water is subject to competition. If we use that water for irrigating pasture or for irrigating cereal crops to feed the animals, we can't then use that water to sustain the ecology, or we can't use that water to provide drinking water for people. So there's a direct competition over those water resources.
Okay. But I mean, also the green water, I'm not sure. I mean, I collect green water at home. We've got a cistern, and I use it to water the garden with, during dry spells. So I think green water can also be collected and used for other purposes. It's not as if it's just falling and it's gone.
Right. That's correct, too. But I think, with a lot of cattle, like the pastures where they're feeding, it tends not to be land that can be used for anything else as well. And it's not really taking water out of the system in that sense either. Yeah. And that varies a lot as well, depending on what country we're talking about.
Yeah. How much does that vary? Is it really, that important where you produce?
So that can vary quite a bit. And another expert that I called up, because of course we don't want to just talk to one person, was someone from the University of Groningen in the Netherlands named Dr. Winnie Lennis. And she's an expert on water resources in the field of environmental sciences, and had done some really interesting work on these comparisons in Europe. And so they were looking at the Netherlands versus Spain, for example. And, the Netherlands is famously very rainy and very green. And Spain is comparatively, in large parts of the country, very dry. This is how she explained it.
The water footprint is far lower than the 15,000 liters that we find on average in literature. For example, for the Netherlands, it's about half, because we have a very efficient production system in the Netherlands. For Spain, it was a bit larger. But then when we start zooming in, looking at the differences between Spain and the Netherlands, we see that in Spain, blue water footprints are a bit larger than in the Netherlands, because in the Netherlands, we do not rely so much on irrigation water. And what we also see that the differences are caused by imports of the Spanish system from outside Spain, mainly from South America, from where they import soybean.
Okay, so yeah, I'm just wondering about that blue water footprint you mentioned in Spain, because having been to Spain last year myself on holiday, all those Airbnbs, a lot of them have pools. And, if you just go into Google Maps and zoom in along the coast of Spain, you'll see a lot of blue pools. They're all full of water. So, yeah, I do wonder about the blue water footprint there also, just with the tourism industry. But bringing it back to Dr. Tim Hess, who's based in the UK, right? Did he happen to say how much water it was for UK beef?
Maybe you want to try to guess this one too, because, okay, so the other professor, Dr. Lennis, she said in the Netherlands, it was about half.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is that? 7,500 liters of water for a kilo of beef. Netherlands, do you think it's the same for the UK? Similar climates, not quite similar landscape.
I don't know. Maybe this is a stereotype, but the Dutch generally are more efficient, I find. So I would say maybe 10,000 in the UK.
Interesting. Okay, well, let's hear what Dr. Hess had to say.
So the figures that we calculated for British beef systems, for example, come out somewhere around 67 liters of that blue water for a kilogram of beef, which is obviously much, much different to the 15,000 liters of water that's quoted as the total, including the blue and the green. But that blue water consumption is really dependent on the production system. So if you're in the Midwest of the USA and you are irrigating maize crops to feed to animals, then you're using mostly blue water. That has a high impact. And we see examples of places where withdrawal of water for irrigating animal feed is causing depletion of aquifers or depletion of rivers and causing significant environmental impacts. But if you're consuming beef that's been produced in Northern Europe, then it probably has a very, very low impact.
Wow. Okay. So my sincere apologies to the British beef industry. I had no idea. Very efficient. But what are the Dutch playing at then? What are they doing?
Well, I mean, okay. So, you know, if we're looking at individual studies, you'd really have to look at the exact parameters and how much green water and blue water we're talking about. Because if I'm not mistaken, Dr. Lettuce was talking about both figures combined. Dr. Hess was talking about just the blue water. But the larger point is that depending on where you're producing, yeah, that blue water impact could be significantly lower. So in response to our listener's comment, it wasn't really a question. Yes and no, 15,000 liters is not incorrect. That figure is true. Those studies have been done. It's more than one study, apparently, that has that figure. But it really depends on where you're talking about. And in some cases, it could be significantly lower, like in the case of British beef. But then if we're talking about, you know, producing leather and how you also take into account the water footprint from the meat industry counts towards the environmental impact of producing leather, I don't think that makes the picture less complicated, because then you have to think of, okay, well, where exactly is it coming from? Where is it being produced? So, you know, most animals in the world that are slaughtered are China, Brazil, and the U.S., you know, with very different conditions in terms of water resources, in terms of landscape, in terms of, yeah, the conditions for the animals, you know, and then considering which countries are exporting those hides. So the U.S. is one of the top exporters of hides, too. And, you know, going back to that episode, a big challenge they have in that industry is also transparency of how these hides are, like, where exactly they're being produced and then exported to. And, you know, if you really wanted to trace where your leather wallet or a belt or shoes or whatever comes from, you're going to have a hard time doing so because it's a huge industry. Yeah, so I don't think we were completely wrong in talking about 15,000 liters. But of course, if you want to be really specific about it, then yeah, it could be significantly lower, but it's still a lot if you add up how many animals go into that industry.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we got that settled.
I hope that made sense. It was a lot of numbers.
Yeah, okay, well, we'll be right back. We're taking a short break. We'll be right back with our favorite moments of 2024.
On this season of Threshold, we'll meet people who are devoting their lives to listening to what other beings are saying.
These animals have incredible social lives. We need a better understanding of how important sound is in their society.
It was a sound that I was completely unfamiliar with, and I could be confident that no human had ever heard that sound before.
Find Threshold wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to our end of year special. Neil here, and I'm in the studio with Kathleen sitting here right beside me, and we want to talk a little bit about some of the topics, some of our favorite topics that we had on Living Planet this year, right? Kathleen, is there anything that springs to mind?
Well, favorite topics? That's such a hard question to answer because I feel like we've had so many different types of topics. And there's, yeah, just a lot that goes on behind the scenes and in interviews or in conversation that doesn't always make it into the episodes. There was one thing that happened recently that was really funny, just to kind of kick this off, which was a few weeks ago, I went to interview a physicist in Cologne, which is, you know, maybe a half an hour from here by train. It's a city of about 1 million people. You know, we're looking at light pollution. So we're walking around at nighttime. And, you know, the interviewee was excellent, had so much to say. There was a lot of conversation. And we were walking through this really dark park, and we were talking about whether this was like the future of lighting in cities, you know, to reduce light pollution, and also talking about whether or not it was safer, you know, with less light, or, you know, whether this could be a problem. And there were a lot of joggers in the park. Mm-hmm. And I kid you not, we had been talking about this, and this jogger nearby completely tripped in the dark. And I know it's not funny, but the irony was a little too much. And yeah, I couldn't get it into the episode because I didn't want to come across as mean-spirited. Mm. And of course, we don't know exactly why the man tripped. That was more of an outtake. I'm not sure that I had any other interviews that where there was like an outtake this year.
I mean, some of the topics that you covered, they were also quite, I mean, heavy. I remember also the farming episode you did about mental health of farmers.
Yeah.
I mean, that was such an important story that hadn't really been done in the media. Mm. And I mean, that was hard.
Yeah. And I think actually, in a way, that was kind of one of my favorite stories that I worked on this year. And that was in the very beginning of the year, where we had been talking about these farmers' protests are going on, mm. not just in Germany, but across, you know, a number of EU countries. Over getting rid of diesel subsidies. Mm. And of course, you know, that would be an environmental win. And the question was, you know, why are these farmers so angry? Is it just about money? And we had been talking about how could we find a fresh angle, because the story is already rolling. Like, you know, how do we bring ourselves into this and find something for our audience? And I felt like that was kind of the perfect example where, you know, like if you're working as a journalist, you know, this feeling of you're looking for a story, you're not quite sure if you have something. But as soon as you put in a call or two, this whole other world opens up and you realize there's this reality for other people that they're living every day and they're talking about it amongst themselves. Mm. And it's something all of us should be talking about, but we don't have any access to it. And that's when you realize you've got a story. And that was very much the case with the German farmers, where I had been researching, trying to find an angle, and just came across, it was like maybe a sentence or two in an article citing somebody who worked for an organization that helped farmers with mental health issues or something like that.
And we're talking about suicides here as well, right? So it's committing suicide because they had to give up their farm. They couldn't deal with the regulations. Yeah. Everything was just getting too much for them, right?
Exactly. It was a whole host of problems. Suicide was one of them. Yeah, and that kind of sparked our interest, and that's how I ended up down that path. But I remember very distinctly talking to different farmers who, you know, not all of them made it into the episode, and they're not known as the chattiest bunch, you know, and
well, they've got work to do.
They do. They're very hard to get a hold of. But yeah, all of them really wanted to talk about this, and it was just very noticeable. I mean, I'm sure you've had that happen with stories too, where you're not sure if you've got something, and then as soon as you talk to somebody, they're like, it's like they've been waiting for you to call them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just remember that, you know, you producing that episode, because we also had a lot of back and forth in the production phase, and it was some of the conversations that you had, and you were just relating them to me. And I remember going home that evening and thinking about that for a long time and talking to my wife about what you had told me, you know, right. the state that these people were in.
Yeah.
And in Germany, where you sort of, it made me kind of wonder, because, you know, you hear these stories where in India, for instance, I remember there was a wave of farmer suicides at one point where they just couldn't deal with the stress anymore and were just being exploited. And then, you know, you have climate change into the equation, etc. But the fact that in Germany, farmers just feel so under pressure to implement a lot of the environmental regulations, which we need, you know, in the agricultural sector to make it sustainable. But, you know, at the same time, maybe we were pushing some people too hard to implement things, you know, with a certain deadline and transform a family business, which has been operating on this basis for decades successfully.
Yeah. And I mean, I think one detail that stuck with me since then was there was a farmer that I went to visit down the road from here. And, you know, this person, he works morning, noon and night. And he was talking about that paperwork, and it was just, I mean, you know, if you or I have to deal with paperwork in our everyday lives, it's a huge pain, you know, and you can just imagine if you have a job like that. And then on top of that, you have to figure out these new regulations. Mm. But he told me over the course of our interview that, you know, there were farmers in this area, and I assume this is also the case in other parts of Germany, who have another job, you know, maybe working for a larger farm that can pay them because, you know, they're not making so much money that they can pay high wages. And they still worked their family farm, but their family farm wasn't profitable. but that's how much it meant to them. They didn't want to lose it. And it wasn't just, you know, a question of like losing land. You know, there was much more to it with that. And that very much came across with those stories of how, you know, it's deeply, deeply personal. And it wasn't just a question of suicide rates. It was more just this kind of open secret that a lot of people were struggling mentally because they're in a really tough spot. And they also felt like they were being scapegoated, you know, for all of our environmental problems when there are people who, you know, they work the land every day. They have a very close relationship to nature in a different way than we do, mm-hmm. I would argue. So, yeah, that's a story I've been thinking about all year as well. Yeah.
Time for a follow-up, maybe.
No, but what about you? I mean, did you have any favorite moments from this year or things that stuck with you?
I'm just going to, you know, go with two rather banal but interesting fun facts. Mm-hmm. It's not really, you know, earth-shattering in terms of environmental science, etc. But the two things that really stuck with me was one was from an episode that Tamsin did on ravens. And the fun fact there is that ravens can actually recognize human faces. So chances are, you know, if a raven has seen you once and you see the raven again, the raven will know it's you. Yeah? And I thought it was great. And the other fun fact was from the ants deep dive that we did on ants. Ants, fascinating creatures.
Our wonderful producer, Natalie Muller.
Natalie Muller, yes. And there was one fun fact in there, and that was that all the ants of this world, if you put them all together, put them on a weighing scales, they weigh more than all the wild birds and mammals combined. And I just find that amazing.
Oh, I don't know what to do with that information at all. But yeah, it is quite fascinating. And I think maybe now's a good time to thank our producers. That's Sam Baker, Jennifer Collins, Natalie Muller, Ben Restle, Charlie Shield, Sarah Steffen, and Tamsin Walker.
Yeah. Can we get some sound effects under that? Some applause or drum rolls?
I think one favorite moment that I had this year was this phrase that our producer, Jennifer Collins, and we have a really nice list of producers, but she has a particularly good turn of phrase in every single script. She did an episode on whether 4 or 5 day work weeks were better for the environment. And she had this sentence where she was going like to the beginning of like the dawn of time, you know, and how like hunter gatherers, you know, like how many hours a week they were working, so to speak. And she said something like, you know, after you've put in your 20 hours of work, you can have a meal or shoot the breeze with somebody. Or maybe do a hunter-gatherer hobby. And I remember just like, that has been cracking me up all year. Because when I read that, I thought, what is a hunter-gatherer hobby? And I had to do the sound for that too. And I thought, how do I come up with a sound for this? But it was, I thought it was so clever and just so, so funny that, yeah, just to even think that way. But seriously, every script, she always had one.
Oh, yeah.
Always.
She's got a great sense of humor as well. But we also have, I mean, you did some digging, right? And you reached out to our producer pool and mm-hmm. asked them for their favorite moments in 2024, right?
Yeah, I had them record a few messages. So we're gonna end the show on that note, hearing from our producers, yeah, what they enjoyed and what was memorable for them.
Hey Kathleen, hey Neil, hello everyone. I'm Charlie, I'm a producer for Living Planet. And this year I worked on 4 different episodes for the show that I found really fascinating in different ways. I worked on a story about the hidden toll of roadkill. And for that I met a moose lady, Laurie the Moose Lady.
My name is Natalie Muller and I'm one of the producers on the show. There have been so many cool facts that I've learned about the world around us, like with fungi. Did you know that an enzyme from a type of fungus, Aspergillus, is used to make Lego? Fungi have so many applications. It's really mind-boggling.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jennifer Collins, and the tea versus coffee episode really sent me down all kinds of rabbit holes. And one of the things I couldn't include in the episode is that the indigenous populations were really big farmers, and their population was wiped out to such an extent that the farmed land turned back into forest and jungle, and that caused a period of global cooling that we now know as the mini ice age in the 1700s. That's according to one study.
Hi everyone, I'm Sarah Steffen. I'd say my favorite moment this year was when I had Neil try that pea protein-based shake for the milk episode. And I can't quite forget the face he made when he drank that.
Hi, this is Ben Restler. One of the standout moments for me this year has got to be working on the birdwatching episode. I went to a Berlin cemetery to attend this workshop, and it involved us staying there overnight, and I got to pitch my tent between tombstones, and that felt pretty peculiar at first. Of course, it was all cleared with the organizers, but pretty soon I got used to the idea and I felt quite comfortable. I actually slept really well.
Hello, this is Tamsin Walker over in Berlin, from where I've recorded the majority of the Naturally Connected segments I've had the pleasure of working on this year. It's been incredible to get to know the nature around me in greater detail, from the trees and the stream in my local park, to the urban foxes, the food under our feet, and the crows. Oh, the crows. I think they've been the most memorable episode for me. And since I recorded it, they've also become regular visitors to my balcony. Sometimes pecking at my flowers, sometimes just watching me while I work, and sometimes making off with plant pots. And I wish I could ask them what they plan to do with them, but I guess that's crow business, and I will just have to let my imagination fill the gap.
Okay, time to wrap this up before the year's out. Many thanks to all our listeners and everybody who's been contributing to this program this past year, starting with our wonderful sound engineers and all the fantastic colleagues at DW's Environment Desk. And if you are still drawing up some resolutions for the new year, why not draft a short and sweet review for Living Planet on the podcasting platform of your choice? It would certainly be a great start to the new year for us to see those popping up in January.